This is David Green. I'm the co-founder of Fearless Media, and I am your host here on Left, Right, and Center. This is the show where we are taking on all the issues, even those tough, divisive ones that you're afraid to talk about with your own family. All right, so the quote of this week to me, "They even broke into my safe." That is what former President Trump said, whining about the FBI search of his Mar-a-Lago home. The safe, yeah, I mean, assuming the FBI, as reported, was looking for classified documents that Trump may have snuck out of Washington, yeah, the safe would be the first place I would check, though I also hope they check the toilets at Mar-a-Lago as well. It does seem like a pretty bad week for the former president, right? I mean, a federal appeals court also ruled that the House Ways and Means Committee can see his taxes from 2015 to 2020. This is something Democrats have been trying to get a look at for years. And Trump was deposed by New York's attorney general. He was required to testify under oath about his business practices. Instead, Trump took the fifth, invoking his right against self-incrimination. This from a man who once said, "If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?" Bad week for him or not? Trump's hardcore supporters get more energized whenever they see developments like this because they believe Trump is the victim of a witch hunt, a narrative that he has, of course, backed up, and this feeds the narrative. Trump is already fundraising off this week, and some Republican campaign operatives are saying that the events this week have all but sealed the GOP nomination for Trump in 2024 if he wants it. So let's bring in our crew. I am your host in your center. On the left, we're joined by Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. On the right, Tara Settmeyer. She's senior advisor at the Lincoln Project, former GOP communications director on Capitol Hill, and resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And we're also joined by our special guest, Renato Mariotti. He's a former federal prosecutor, also the host of the podcast On Topic. Liz, Tara, Renato, how are you all?
Doing great.
Doing well, thanks.
Busy week.
Well, thanks for being here. Renato, I want to start with you. I mean, this was a big show of force by the FBI in Florida. Is this all about potentially mishandling classified documents, or do you think there's more here?
Well, it appears to be about classified documents. I don't think it's all just about mishandling classified documents in the way that, you know, people might have been familiar from the Hillary Clinton investigation, which, of course, famously turned into nothing when James Comey mentioned that that's not the sort of thing that the FBI typically prosecutes without more. I do think that there was a plus factor here, and some of the reports that we're seeing, if they are accurate, seem to suggest that there were some ongoing discussions between the Justice Department and Trump's team. I think there's reporting that the grand jury subpoena was issued for documents, and some classified documents have been returned. But it appears that they had some evidence, perhaps an individual on the inside who was giving them information that there were some documents, classified documents, that were being held back from the Justice Department by Trump's team. And my understanding, based on what we've seen so far with the reporting, is that this was in part to retrieve those classified documents that, for whatever reason, Trump was trying to hide from the federal government.
I mean, you want to believe that law enforcement operates in a vacuum separate from politics, but I mean, we're not stupid. The Justice Department, I mean, they had to be thinking about the political implications and how the nation would watch all of this, right? I mean, were those conversations happening before this took place?
Yes, probably, or that's what I would expect. I would just say a couple things. I mean, I do think the Justice Department is not political in the sense that they are targeting people for political reasons. That is not my experience at the Justice Department. I have seen no evidence to suggest that that is been occurring here.
No matter what Trump tries to do to suggest that.
Correct. So I want to make sure I clarify that on the front end. However, I would expect that the Justice Department would be concerned about the way that this would be perceived by the nation. But regardless, whatever folks at the Justice Department were considering this had to think about the impact on the nation.
If this becomes another nothing, as you talked about when we were talking about Hillary Clinton, I mean, could that be a huge setback for the Justice Department and its credibility?
Well, it depends on the circumstances. You know, let's just say that the reporting that we've heard, if it was accurate, that, for example, the Justice Department had requested classified documents from former President Trump and had received some documents but had been misled or lied to in some way regarding documents that were there, and they ended up having to do this to retrieve them, I don't know. I think that would be a debate that people would have regarding whether or not that was justified or not. But, you know, nonetheless, I have the feeling that no matter what steps the Justice Department took, it would have been seen as unfair or political by Mr. Trump's allies. So I think that the Justice Department was in a difficult position there.
Liz, the former president, when he announced this search, he said nothing like this has ever happened to a president of the United States before. I mean, the FBI was rummaging through a former president's home. Does Trump have a point in that regard?
I mean, Watergate was a fairly extensive investigation.
Yeah, fairly important too.
Yeah, and I mean, Clinton was pretty extensively investigated as well during his impeachment proceedings. You know, there's precedent for presidents being investigated, and you know, maybe this is the first time a former president has been investigated for an offense of this magnitude, such that it's prompted an actual FBI raid on a former president's personal, you know, private residence. Again, I don't really think it's a commentary on, you know, the deep state or the FBI as an agency. It's sort of a comment on his own behavior. So, yes, you know, in some respects, this is a completely novel situation, but it's a result of his completely novel, bizarre behavior. So I'm not sure who's supposed to be reflected upon poorly by his observation there. It's not the FBI.
Yeah, I mean, the FBI has to take an extraordinary measure when the behavior is that extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, when people start doing extraordinarily strange crimes, the law enforcement agencies have to respond in extraordinarily weird investigative ways. But that's definitely the situation here. So
yeah, and potential crimes that undermine our entire democracy. So this is not a small deal. But Tara, let me ask you. I mean, one part of Team Trump's messaging around all of this is that we are all in danger, that the FBI could come to our house next. Leora Levy, she just won the GOP Senate primary in Connecticut. She was endorsed by Trump. She won this surprise victory in the primary after the Mar-a-Lago raid. She said the search was an assault on our freedom and liberty. And I mean, just watching this week play out, the former president's ability to personalize something like this for individual voters and take the focus off of the potential crimes that he may have committed and his behavior so people feel victimized alongside him. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, however you feel about Donald Trump and his messaging operation, he has been genius in that ability to draw people in. That's what con artists do. That's what cult leaders do. And I've been very critical of this over the years, but you have to admire, if you want to say, his ability to do this. It's been incredibly effective. Millions and millions of people feel a personal connection through Donald Trump. When you ask people about why they support him, or why, when he made the comment that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any supporters, a lot of us scoffed at that and thought that was absurd. This is the political equivalent of that. From January 6th on, in all of the information we've found, we have seen that it has virtually not moved the needle at all as far as Republican support for Donald Trump. It's been negligible. And that's because he had this unique ability to draw people in. A lot of that, there are a lot of factors, I think, that contributed to that. First off, people feel connected to him because of his years on The Apprentice and beamed into people's homes through that program, made him very popular and, you know, splashed on tabloids, and his very plain talk. Even though he was a billionaire, he's kind of the common man's billionaire, making people think that he wasn't part of the upper class there. And he was never really accepted by that higher, you know, upper echelon of society too. So that was another way. He was always sticking it to the establishment, you know, even before he got into politics, and people related to that. He gave them a voice. And we are seeing that play out day after day alongside an entire right-wing media ecosystem that has boosted that. It's reinforced those messages. Unfortunately, a lot of it is misinformation. A lot of it is lies. We know that the Washington Post cataloged 30,000 plus lies or falsehoods told during the Trump administration. That's unprecedented. But it doesn't matter to the people who support him because they feel a personal connection. He gives them a voice. And that is a really powerful, difficult connection to overcome, which we're seeing, and which is why we see the Republican Party struggle with trying to offload from Trump and Trumpism, because now it's not managed for them, which is why you see so many falling in line, even though they know better. They know this is dangerous.
They know they have no choice.
Right.
I mean, they have to fall in line or lose.
Or lose their elections and lose power.
Do the right thing, so to speak, and not be in office anymore.
That's right. We've seen plenty of examples of it so far in the primaries.
Renato, can you take me inside the Justice Department, inside the New York Attorney General's office? Like, how do you keep doing your job when you are investigating this man amid the political just theater that is happening around all of this? Have you ever been in a situation like that before? And is it even possible to shut off the politics, that which we know are going to be growing more and more intense heading into this fall, heading into 2024? Can you shut that off and actually just focus on the law?
So I'll say a couple of things. First of all, as a starting point, I have never been in a situation like that. I prosecuted cases that I thought were high profile. nothing like this at all. And, you know, I was at a U.S. attorney's office that when we prosecuted Rod Blagojevich, the office prosecutor Rod Blagojevich, and that was a very big deal at the time.
In Illinois, yeah.
Yeah, at the time, the president-elect, Barack Obama, was interviewed by the FBI as part of the investigation, even though he was not alleged to have engaged in any wrongdoing in any way. And that alone was a big deal at the time, but that pales in comparison to this as well. So I do think that it is going to be a challenge there. One thing I will say is that, you know, the usual DOJ playbook when there is any sort of attention drawn to a case is to say as little as possible. You keep your head down. You don't make public statements. And legally, that makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
Because anything the Justice Department says can be used later by the defense to claim that, for example, the jury pool had been tainted in some way or something along those lines. And it also just keeps you out of trouble. We saw James Comey try to change that playbook, and it didn't work out very well.
Didn't go well, no.
Yeah. And so I think that that's generally the strategy. And it does have its benefits.
I tend to always like to hear more, especially when a vacuum is being filled by someone like Trump and his team. I mean, you're totally right about Comey that not going well when he did that. But it's like, given the reality here that probably the Justice Department is going to be accused of being weaponized for political purposes, no matter where this goes, it's like I kind of want to hear from them in this political moment.
But there's one important point, I think, that is getting lost in a lot of this discussion, the national security implications potentially. I know a lot of us have kind of just glossed over, oh, it's Presidential Records Act, or, you know, he just mishandled classified documents. That is actually really serious. And it has been reported that Jay Bratt, who is the head of the Counterintelligence and Export Control section of the DOJ, and Renato, I'm sure, knows this division well, what they are involved in tells me that this is more serious than just love letters from Kim Jong-un. So, you know, I mean, the counterintelligence and export control section, I mean, they handle sanctions, atomic energy, export of military technology, espionage, sabotage. Those are kinds of things that this division of the DOJ handles.
Documents that you don't want out there in the world.
Exactly, which is probably why it was held so close, that why the DOJ is interested in this, and why they really don't want that information out there, because if they, even if listing the inventory of what they took, could be a national security risk. So, I would hope that people understand why the Department of Justice is staying mum and wants to litigate this through the courts and not in the court of public opinion, as frustrating as that is for those who want to know.
I mean, people who work for Republicans with 2024 aspirations are freaking out right now. John Thomas, he's a strategist who's supporting Ron DeSantis, told Politico after this raid, it will be a coronation at this point, not a primary, that Trump has basically a lock on the nomination. Liz, do you think that's where we are? I mean, all the legal questions and investigations aside, I mean, does Trump now have a clear path to nomination if he wants it after this? Does this lock it in?
I don't know. I think that's a little premature. I think, you know, people are overreactive because they were stunned by 2016. They didn't see it coming, and they don't want to get caught off guard again. I'll say I have no idea what's going to happen with the you know, next general election. But I'll say this, you know, this sequence of events hasn't played itself out yet. I would not necessarily call it on what the effect of this investigation or these multiple different threads of investigations going to be until the narratives have sort of played themselves out. So these are the opening salvos of what appear to be sort of several different plot lines involving several different areas of, you know, alleged malfeasance on Trump's part. Let's see how those things unfold. And then I think we'll have a clearer picture of how they may affect his electoral chances. One thing that can happen with candidates, you know, no matter how well beloved or how good at owning the libs, which is, I think, Trump's still number one draw, and it's still something he remains incredibly good at, is that there's always somebody who can do it better with fewer problems. You know, after a while, you just have an accrual of issues. And it's not that there's any one issue or any one scandal that completely breaks or, you know, totally dominates the candidate's character and makes them unpalatable in a huge way. It's just this sort of never-ending onslaught of little issues and ticky-tacky things that the supporter has to pay attention to constantly that may be an issue. You know, somebody like DeSantis, somebody like Tom Cotton even, they can provide the same kind of ownage with relatively limited numbers of those kinds of scandals, at least for the time being, just because they seem to run tighter ships. So I think keeping in mind those kinds of possibilities on how this may all play out is at this point prudent before calling it.
All right. We are going to say goodbye to Renato Mariotti at this point, former federal prosecutor. Thanks for joining us today. Really, really great stuff helping us understand this crazy week.
My pleasure.
And I will be back with Tara Settmeyer of the Lincoln Project and Liz Brunig of The Atlantic. We're going to talk about Inflation Nation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Okay, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, the co-founder of Fearless Media and your center. On the right, Tara Settmeyer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. And on the left, we have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. So inflation numbers finally are down. Are you feeling that? I mean, it might depend on what you've been up to. If you're gassing up your car, if you're buying plane tickets, prices do seem a little less shocking, though the prices for food and other goods remain very high. Democrats have been doing some slightly shady political messaging of their own. This massive bill that squeaked past the Senate with the vice president's tie-breaking vote, they're calling it the Inflation Reduction Act. Does it clearly do things to reduce inflation? Maybe, though nonpartisan economic forecasters say that's minimal at best. Who knew as well that the most groundbreaking policy to combat climate change in our nation's history would be part of something called the Inflation Reduction Act? That's how legislating works. It's all part of a new and improved reconciliation bill that West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, you know, the guy who runs the agenda of our entire country, finally signed off on. So let's talk about this. Liz, have you been feeling less inflation in your life?
I mean, you know, I don't want to underrate it. Obviously, the decrease in gas prices broke a certain feverish sort of narrative that was building up, and with good reason.
Oh, I like the breaking a fever metaphor. That is totally true. It's like gets so high and then has to come back down.
As long as it's rising, I mean, you feel this pressure that's sort of ratcheting up and up and up and up. And you know, there needs to be a ceiling on that, and there needs to be some sign of decrease. And so that happening, I think, is an important step, at least politically. It changes the, you know, the mood, the vibe in a meaningful way. On the other hand, you know, materially, prices are still very high.
Yeah.
And inflation is at least partially responsible, along with a lot of other epiphenomena that came around during the pandemic. And that's going to be a problem for Democrats. It's going to be a problem for Democrats as the midterms approach. It's potentially going to be a problem for Democrats going into the general, unless that there's something, you know, pretty tremendous they can do to get it under control in the short term. On the other hand, these things can be really difficult to control, even if you are, you know, at least nominally for the time being, in control of the both houses of Congress and the executive. There's only so much control that Congress even can exert over the economy.
So are Democrats being honest when they basically promise to the nation this big legislation is going to reduce inflation?
I think they're being hopeful. And I think that that's their intent. And I think they recognize it as a serious political problem. But I think the degree to which that goal is even within their control is you know, remains to be seen.
Tara, let's talk about this big bill. I mean, that is has the promise or the hope, as Liz said, of reducing inflation. There's a ton in here. As you look at it overall, I mean, you had 50 Republicans in the Senate saying no to this, a lot of them expressing concern, saying that this is at best not going to do anything to help working families. At worst, it's going to hurt working families. I mean, is the Republican argument, is there some credence there?
From a political perspective, we've mentioned this before, the branding of this as the Inflation Reduction Act is actually a really good political move, whether it does or doesn't. It's all about the perception in politics, and the Democrats desperately needed a short-term win. Republicans are looking at this from the same lens that they have for many years. And when I worked on Capitol Hill, it was all about cap and trade. And the stimulus bill back in 2009 with President Obama when he came into office. And that was full of a lot of big government spending on alleged green shovel-ready jobs and all of these promises at a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars, that didn't really turn out too well. It turned into boondoggles. And I think Republicans were concerned that this was just another attempt at trying to push climate change legislation that isn't necessarily going to impact everyday lives immediately, and that it turns into more government bureaucracy and funding of that. It sounds great that they want to include $7,500 tax credits for people to buy electric vehicles, but right. I, you know, electric cars are averaging $60,000. I don't know too many middle class or lower to middle class families that can afford that in order to get a $7,500 tax credit. So who does it benefit? It benefits wealthier people. Some of the regulations that are supposedly streamlined with permitting and things like that, well, hopefully that happens. But when you're putting billions of dollars into block grants and climate justice programs to study this or that, that doesn't feel like it's going to help families every single day. So it remains to be seen. But I do understand Republicans' concerns about this, given the history of the approach to climate change and climate policy that we saw back in 2009 that didn't really work out so well.
Liz, a lot there from Tara, that the Obama stimulus bill turned out to be a boondoggle and that a lot of these policies that Democrats say is going to help working families actually won't. How do you react to that?
Well, I mean, I think there's also the, you know, general agreement that the Obama stimulus bill was sort of responsible for, you know, what soft of a landing there was to the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, I think the left would agree with you that there was quite a bit of misspent money and a lot of misspent political opportunities that came out of the Obama administration's response to the 2008 financial crisis, especially with respect to dealing with the banks and some pretty obvious, I think, criminal negligence at the very least going on at the executive level there and Obama's unwillingness to prosecute. I think there were some incredible missed opportunities on that level. And in terms of bailing out the banks, I think that will always be something that the left has pretty significant disagreements with even the mainstream liberal element of the Democratic Party on. On the other hand, you know, to the degree that even during the pandemic, there was direct assistance going to families, I think you saw that making a significant difference. And, you know, as we're still reeling from the effects of the pandemic, I don't understand why this assistance going direct to families would make any less of a difference. We're still dealing with the same after effects of the same economic crisis that was just helpfully reversed by policies that are very similar in form and function. So I don't really understand why they would stop helping now. They helped during the last administration.
But let me dig into some of what Tara brought up about adding money to federal agencies and bureaucracy. I mean, there is a ton of money, $80 billion here going to the IRS. I mean, much of it to beef up enforcement. And this seems to be kind of a critical, not just policy, but philosophical argument. It's like the Democrats would say, you add a bunch of money to the IRS, they're going to go after wealthier people, corporations, and make sure the government is bringing all the money that they have to. The Republicans are saying, hang on a second, like working families who are already struggling to pay their taxes, this is going to mean, I mean, maybe it's fair because enforcement should happen, but like it's going to mean more people paying higher taxes who don't have extra money to spend right now. I mean, Tara, how do you see this IRS money playing out?
Well, I can understand some aspects of having to increase funding for the IRS, given the backlogs that we've seen. You know, it's no one complains when they get their tax refund checks, but they do complain when they take too long to process them. Well, you have to hire more people to do that. But that's not necessarily what this is doing. This is really for targeting tax cheats. So if you're not cheating on your taxes, you shouldn't have to worry about this.
Right.
But Republicans for years have kept the IRS in their sights because they've felt that there has been overreach or that the IRS has been weaponized. Many years ago, many will remember that the IRS was allegedly going after nonprofit organizations, conservative ones, unfairly. And that was a big point of contention for Republicans politically to use as another one of the big bad government agencies. And plus, no one likes the IRS, let's be honest. But
sadly for them, but that's very true.
Right, right. It's probably the most hated agency. You know, those the scariest three letters. You don't ever want to see anything from the IRS. But necessary nonetheless to collect revenue, right? There is no money tree on the West Lawn of the Capitol. It is collected through tax revenue. That's how we fund the government. But Republicans, I think, see a political opportunity here, you know, to use this as a way to scare people and gin them up into saying, oh, see, the government's coming after you. It's part of what we were talking about before. It's, you know, they're coming after all of us. And I don't necessarily agree with that, but the Republicans are effectively using this. If you listen to people who are polled or interviewed talk about, oh my gosh, the IRS is now going to come after everyday folks. Why are we spending money there? It's very effective messaging on their part because they know it's relatable, whether it's true or not. So I think that Republicans may be overstating what this $80 billion for the IRS actually means to the average everyday people, but it's a very effective message that they've used before, and the Democrats have handed that to them by including this funding in this particular bill.
Yeah, Liz, why do this? I mean, why give a ton of new money to a very unpopular agency in a way that does feel like, as Tara said, it feeds this narrative of that your government is out to get you, just like we were talking about with Mar-a-Lago and the Trump team making this big a thing, like, you know, your government could come, you know, break down your door at any moment. That doesn't seem like a helpful narrative for Democrats at this point.
The IRS needs money. The IRS needs money. And as Tara said, there are significant backlogs and so forth that need sorting out. And the IRS does do good things, too. I mean, everybody's happy when they get their tax returns, right?
That's fair.
I mean, why Democrats, you know, continually pursue these sort of ambiguous policies that have reasonable backstories that you can support, but almost assiduously avoid obviously great policies that everybody would love and celebrate, like childcare or child allowances, you know, this expanded permanent child tax credit. That's the real mystery to me, because that would just make life straight up easier for families all over the country. Everybody knows kids are expensive and they don't make money. They just cost money. And so getting a little check every month to help you out with the cost of raising kids, especially after we've just gone through the pandemic and we're still dealing in different parts of the country with residual waves that knock out daycare or school. When you're trying to work as a parent, having that kind of help can be really, really incredible.
This is what Bernie Sanders was fighting for, right? To include
absolutely.
The legislation. And, yeah, and not a single Democrat supported him.
Not a single Democrat would support it, right? Because this is the kind of thing that pisses off Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. They don't believe in those kinds of expenditures. They don't like those kinds of expenditures. That's socialism, et cetera, et cetera. And so you get these ridiculous votes like 97-1 or something like that. The Democrats are, you know, virtually allergic to the kind of policies that in other countries left parties view as their red meat that they throw out to their constituencies, which would be things like an expanded permanent child tax credit, or, you know, a kind of subsidized government credit for childcare. You know, Democrats just can't pull it off.
And but wouldn't it's that look like it was the party, quote unquote, caving to the Progressive Caucus and
caving to the children, caving to the kids who need the daycare?
No, but I mean, isn't that the fear? And I'm not saying that it's a fear that they should listen to, but the fear of the White House and the fear of Schumer would be like, this will look like that the party's going left.
Yeah, looks like we're going to wimp out and go left for families with kids, folks. I mean, I would just accept the hate. I'd be like, yep, look, we wimped out and we caved into our left wing for families with children and just make ad after ad with
kids.
Well,
that's an interesting point. Like, I mean, the messaging right now, you said ambiguous is a word that the Democrats are suffering from right now when it comes to these ambiguous policies that they can't seem to message well. I mean, what is going on?
Right. The Democrats, I think, are constantly in the throes of some kind of identity crisis, and they can't figure out how to pitch themselves or what their multiple constituencies want to hear. The Democrats are a party of lots of different types of people. They're a big tent, broad constituency party, and they can't figure out what unites all these different kinds of people. Let me help you. Lots of different kinds of people either were kids, are going to have kids, or have kids right now. That's just a common thing that happens to most people at some point in their lives. And so if you want to throw out some red meat, be like, we're going to make it affordable and easy to deal with the kids issue, because especially for poor people, having kids is way too expensive and is an enormous financial burden. That is something that, you know, they could make their identity, but they don't want to.
Tara, I mean, you're a conservative. Would you have, if the Democrats had come and made a very strong, compelling case and said, we're going to include the child tax credit in this piece of legislation, I mean, how would you have reacted to that?
Well, I think that would have been more palatable than $80 billion for the IRS.
So what are Democrats thinking?
I don't know. As the Democrats, believe me, as a, you know, as a former Republican, but still conservative, I often wonder why it's so difficult for them to message this the way that Republicans have for years. Like, they know how to take these issues and break it down and make it easy for people to understand. You know, it's the bumper sticker approach to things. And sometimes it's not always honest, but it's effective politically. And so just look at, you know, to Liz's point about like the children, kids are always an issue. You know, do it for the children. It's a win-win political issue if you message it correctly. I mean, look at how successful Republicans were during the off-year elections in states like Virginia and even New Jersey, using school agendas and the children as an effective mobilizing tool. I mean, in Virginia, you convinced a lot of moderates who supported Joe Biden to vote Republican again, strictly off the school issue. And Democrats were left flat-footed on that. They still don't have an answer for it, particularly with the culture war stuff. I mean, Republicans are in a lot of states are looking to ban books. They are trying to take over, you know, school agendas. Teachers are quitting left and right. And it's because of this chaos, and there's been no answer. So it is very frustrating, because I think that could be a winning issue, particularly after the way so many parents, whether you're Republican or Democrat, struggled during COVID to deal with childcare when their kids weren't in school. So what are they supposed to do once they go back to work? How do you balance that? That's something that everyone can relate to who has a family. So I wish that for Democrats, for their sake, if they would learn to stop focusing on the, you know, how many zeros and the, you know, the policy pen minutia of things, and learn how to message some of these policies that could be beneficial to everyone a bit better, they could take that narrative back, but they don't.
Liz, whose failing is it? Is it President Biden? Is it Chuck Schumer? Is it Nancy Pelosi? Is it just the fact that the Democrats don't have an effective messenger when it comes to moments like this? I mean, who's dropping the ball?
I would say that all of those people see it as not their responsibility to message.
Well, that's a problem.
And they're relying on the messaging to happen somewhere on, you know, closer to the grassroots level. But grassroots organizers, by and large, are issue organizers. They're organizing around particular issues. They're issue advocates. And so they have strong messaging around what they're doing and what they're organizing around, but they're not organizing around a party or trying to create a visible identity for a party. And so you get grassroots messaging coming out at the national level from Democrats. And that is unusual and sort of strange and exotic to your average American who's hearing a lot of grassroots issue advocacy messages coming from the Democrats, which can be a good thing, right? I mean, they often have very good points, but it doesn't amount to a solidified sort of party identity for the Democrats. And I'm not sure anyone over there views it as their job to come up with one of those.
Which is a huge, huge problem in the party right now, I think. All right, we've been talking with Elizabeth Brunig and Tara Settmeyer. We're going to come back and look inside Senator Manchin's deep pockets in West Virginia. That's next. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. On the left today, we have Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic, and on the right, Tara Settmeyer, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. So for Democrats who are fighting to combat climate change, Senator Joe Manchin has, as we know, been a major stumbling block. But after hemming and hawing, Manchin came through and signed on to this landmark climate legislation that is so aptly part of the, quote, Inflation Reduction Act. Did Manchin just have this existential moment, a catharsis? Was he like, God, I really need to save the planet now? Well, no. There was a quid pro quo here. For supporting this bill, the West Virginia Democrat got support for the long-stalled Mountain Valley Pipeline in his state. This is a gas pipeline that would span over 300 miles and cut through the Appalachian Mountains. That is just one of the concessions that will help his financial supporters in the fossil fuel industry. So in order to pass what will be the nation's biggest climate legislation ever to potentially reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 2005 levels, Democrats had to agree to support a pipeline that furthers our nation's use of fossil fuels. So I want to bring in a special guest for this discussion. It's Alexa Beyer. She's an environment and energy reporter for Mountain State Spotlight out of West Virginia. And she recently reported on the price for getting Manchin's support of this new climate policy. Alexa, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I'm happy to be here.
Well, tell us what you found in your reporting on this Mountain Valley pipeline and Manchin's support of getting this thing built.
Yeah. Well, the important thing to realize about the Mountain Valley Pipeline is that without Manchin's support, it wouldn't be able to happen. So currently, it's about 4 years past the date when they were supposed to be in operation. The project cost has ballooned. It's now over $3 billion over what they estimated. They've had partners leave. Everything's at a standstill. And the reason it's been at a standstill is because the project developers have not proposed a project that complies with the law. And so in this long history of the Mountain Valley Pipeline, you know, getting different permits from different federal agencies, these agencies have gone out of their way to try and approve the pipeline, even when it breaks their own rules. For instance, there was a thing with water crossings. The pipeline seeks to cross about 600 bodies of water in West Virginia. They couldn't do all of them within 72 hours, which is a requirement for water crossing permits in the state. And so the Army Corps of Engineers just, they tried to waive it, saying, well, you're doing a more environmentally beneficial method than what the law was created for, then so we'll just waive it. So, you know, there's this history of these agencies bending the rules, and now in here comes Manchin saying, I'm going to change the referee.
I mean, was Manchin open about that? Like, did people who live in this part of West Virginia where this pipeline is going, did they know that this kind of backdoor dealing, changing jurisdiction for this project was happening in Washington?
I recently took a trip out to like three of the counties where the pipeline's going through, and some of the residents who are really tapped in to the battle against the pipeline, yes, they knew it. Some of them were predicting it, that something like this would happen. They had seen him say he supported it. They had seen the pipeline ask for important things that they needed, like high stakes political junctures. But I mean, I don't think necessarily like most people were expecting this.
Liz, can people who are passionate about doing whatever it takes to curb emissions and fight climate change still feel good about this bill, knowing what we're learning now about what's happening in West Virginia?
I guess. I mean,
love that answer.
Politics is like this, I suppose. I mean, Joe Manchin is like this. Whoever's writing a book on this guy needs to send me a galley, is all I'll say.
You want to edit it, or you want to review it? What is?
I just want to review that. I just want to see that before it comes out. Just give me a chance to blurb it or something, because this dude is one of the more interesting political figures of the 21st century, in that a lot of very bad things are attributable to him personally. And if I were him, I wouldn't like myself very much.
Why not? What bothers you the most?
You know, just dishonesty on climate change, willingness to make these sort of deals with the devil that are like flagrantly in violation of the values I purport to have to one part of the country, an obvious and sort of gleeful amorality, imperviousness to any sort of criticism regarding one's motives or personal conduct or how it affects other people in the world, and just an obdurate refusal to take responsibility for routinely screwing up major legislation that could improve the lives of millions of people, namely poor children. If that was me, I would regard myself as sucking somewhat. And that's Joe Manchin regularly. And that's been his history in the, you know, at this point, short-lived Biden administration. So interested to see what this guy does next. But, I can at least say that this behavior of his in West Virginia versus this national legislation is fitting.
Well, you know, if I didn't want to read your review of this book about Manchin before, I definitely want to read it now. Tara, was this a deal with the devil?
Well, I mean, I don't look at it as extreme as some others do, because Joe Manchin is just doing what senators do in that's important to their states. I mean, West Virginia is a coal-producing fossil fuel state. And, you know, people can acknowledge that climate change has impacted some of these jobs and that we need to do things to move to renewable and clean energy, and that's fine, but that's not an overnight solution. That's long-term. And you can start making those adjustments in a measured way. I mean, West Virginia has been impacted considerably by the loss of coal jobs. I mean, in the 1990s, you had 100,000 people in West Virginia who were employed in the coal industry in some capacity. Today, it's down to 14,000. And so when you have things like pipelines and these types as Republicans say, the all of the above energy approach to things, it helps the state of West Virginia. So, I mean, West Virginia is in the lowest categories when it comes to poverty and when it comes to opioid use and it comes to unemployment and healthcare. Like, all of these things are impacted by loss of jobs and loss of economic security there. And so, you know, I don't know that it's always just so, if he's just lining his pockets for special interests and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's always an aspect of that, I guess, when you're dealing in politics and making these deals. But it also does have a direct impact on the economic health of his state. So I think we just need to put it in perspective.
Well, I mean, Alexa, can you help me put in perspective? I mean, Manchin obviously has gotten a lot of attention because he played such a role in determining the Democrats' agenda recently. But other senators make deals that benefit financial supporters, right?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. It's true. And so in some respects, yes, he's doing what senators do. But where I will push back against Tara's point is that this is something that West Virginians, by and large, were asking him for. So yes, it did create a number of jobs. I spoke to someone who runs a union construction trade, and he was saying that people got a lot more work during peak building times for the pipeline. That said, the pipeline is 95% built. They're just held up at these broader crossings and stuff, right? So Manchin's decision to do it actually didn't create any more jobs for West Virginians. And then there's, you know, the facts that we are historically a coal-dependent state, and that's true. That said, of the people I spoke with, a number of them, when unprompted, like, it's kind of a thing where if you're like, well, what about the problem? So the coal industry has had it. It's like, no, like the coal industry has been very supportive of this state. But when unprompted, just talking about this, they said, yeah, actually us being the sacrifice zone in this reminds us, it feels like a next version of what happened with coal, with timber, where West Virginians were making the sacrifice and forced to work in these insane conditions in the name of powering the rest of the country, which, yes, put food on the table for many of us, but came at a serious cost. And why are we again and again designated as the sacrifice zone for the rest of the country?
I just want to finish by saying there's something weird. I mean, I know there are a lot of questions here. I know that there was some backdoor dealing, but just thinking about raids on former presidents' homes and a lot of the drama that we've been seeing, like a debate over special interests and backdoor dealing to get a big piece of legislation through Congress, that feels so old-fashioned in some kind of like not bad way. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, that's back to business as usual, I guess, with legislating. I think it's important for the American people to see that at least things are getting done. How the sausage is made is not always pretty, but, you know, welcome to politics.
As they say of Italian politics, there's graft and honest graft.
Well, what a good place to end. I want to thank Alexa Beyer, environment and energy reporter at Mountain State Spotlight. You really helped us get a picture of what's happening in West Virginia and Manchin. Alexa, thanks for your reporting and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, so we've reached that time again for our Left, Right, and Center rants. We feature pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, let me give the soapbox to you first.
July 28th, the state of Alabama executed Joe Nathan James. They had scheduled to execute him at 6 p.m., but he was declared dead at 9:27. So far, the state of Alabama has given no explanation for what happened during the missing 3 hours, except to say that sometimes it takes some time to set an IV line. I'd like to know more. I'm looking into it. I don't appreciate it when states lie about what goes on with their executions, and especially when they dissemble because they have secrecy. Execution states have been slipping more into secrecy and privacy laws regarding what they're doing with public money in the course of killing citizens behind closed doors. I don't appreciate that at all. I don't think anybody else should either.
Wow. Okay. Tara.
As the granddaughter of a police officer and the wife of a federal officer, I'm very sensitive when law enforcement is attacked unfairly. And this week, hearing Republicans advocating for defunding the FBI because they executed a legal search warrant on former President Trump is really infuriating. Not only are they hypocrites, because these are the same people who went after the defund the police progressive movement in 2020, but they also claim to back the blue. No, they don't. They attack the blue. You cannot selectively decide when you want to support law enforcement and law and order and when you don't, and then to fundraise off of it. It's irresponsible, it's hypocritical, and it's dangerous, and shame on them.
Okay, I want to rant about Ukraine and a report from Amnesty International. They were calling on Ukraine's military to stop launching attacks from areas populated with civilians and to stop setting up military assets in schools and hospitals because it was turning these places into targets for Russian forces. Now, Amnesty said that Ukraine doing these things never justifies indiscriminate Russian attacks, but Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Amnesty of shifting blame and playing into Russia's hands. And Amnesty is taking a beating with resignations now. They do say they regret causing pain for Ukrainians. And I mean, let's be honest, they should have pointed out in the report that Russia by far is the one playing dirty in this war and causing horrific loss of life. But let's not lose this. Let's not forget that Amnesty was trying to get to the truth. And truth is vital in a real democracy, which is what so much of the world thinks we are fighting for by supporting Ukraine. So I know President Zelensky had to criticize this report, but I just hope he's careful. I mean, truth, transparency, accountability, these are values we want for his country. So while I can't possibly imagine the pressures on Zelensky and the horrors of war around him, I hope in moments like this, he is also thinking about playing the long game. All right, that's all the time we have today. I want to thank Tara Settmeyer and Elizabeth Brunig, also Renato Mariotti and Alexa Beyer. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Jenna Cagle. Our production assistant is Alexander Applegate. The show is recorded and mixed by John Meek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. I'm David Green. Thank you for being here, and I hope you tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.